The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and my guest today is a interesting man, John Rappaport. John's been doing what he's been doing for probably nearly as long as I've been doing what I've been doing. And John may be able to remember back to when we first talked. I'm having a little trouble recalling because it's so long ago, and I'm sure I was on one of his earlier radio shows talking about psychiatry and the psychopharmaceutical complex and the way money and power infiltrates, corrupts, and now has nearly abolished what's good in psychiatry. John has his own website that he developed years ago called nomorefakenews.com that tells you a lot about him. He's been very interested in international cartels, money, the money in banking and the military and the health and a number of others. He's really devoted his life into looking beneath the surface of the relationships that move what happens here on Earth. I'm not sure where we're going to go today. I hope we'll go some into how much our knowledge about the psychopharmaceutical complex has changed since I first wrote about it in Toxic Psychiatry back in 1991. And we'll talk about whatever he would like to talk about as well. John, hello and welcome to my show. I've already been on your show.
Great to be here, Peter. Thanks very much. Always enjoy talking with you.
Tell me what you'd like to talk about today. What's on your mind?
Well, you know, what I've been writing about in recent times is how the whole concept of mental illness, especially when you combine it with pharmaceutical impact, dampens creativity and imagination in people. Because, of course, in society now, everything has to be compartmentalized. We have to use words like weapons, and we have to categorize people and put them into little niches and say, you've got this mental disorder and this kid over here has that disorder, and therefore we have to drug you into submission, and of course this is a cure, and all of this goes on with enormous profit taking and profit making and cooperation of government entities. But as far as the society, the civilization itself, and ultimately the individual, it's all about attempting to deceive people into believing that you really can look at the human mind and carve it up into these categories, and that people are this way, and there's some sort of tremendous insight to be gained from knowing the right labels to apply to different behaviors and ideas and states of mind and all of this kind of nonsense. And so in the end, what happens is the imagination, which is really the prow of the ship that leads people forward in their own lives, is being submerged under the weight of all of this absolute nonsense. And people buy into it because it sounds scientific, it sounds legitimate, and there are all sorts of authorities and experts that back it up, and media pay homage to these various pundits and so-called experts that get on and begin to talk about what's ailing children these days and adults and so on and so forth. it's all a gigantic fairy tale. It's all a gigantic myth. And it's being propagated by people who, at different levels, profit from it in different ways. And I see this all the time. I see people who take their own lives and twist them around in order to fit this picture of reality. And in the process, their own best ideas, the ideas that would lead them forward to live creative lives, are dampened and put on the shelf, because all of a sudden it's all about disorders and mental illness and what's wrong with this person and that person. And it's a tragedy.
I'm really with you on this, and on the tragic aspects. I think imagination is one way, a good way of looking at what the suppression is about. I'm sure you'll agree that closely connected is the suppression of free will, of volition, of taking charge of our lives, of taking responsibility for our lives. I'm right now evaluating the case of a young woman in her 20s who was put on psychiatric drugs at the age of 5. And the first exposure to the drug within a matter of days made her psychotic. And they didn't tell her that it was the drug. They told her it was bipolar disorder inherited from her father, when they had just poisoned her and caused this great disturbance. And it leads to this lifetime of confusion and distress, obfuscation of what life is about. Imagination is, of course, knocked out. And I think the core of the person is dampened, which is that decision-making, even in a five-year-old, you know, they can begin to make decisions about what's right, what's wrong, how do they want to behave. They can respond to adult guidance from parents or teachers or others, significant people in their lives. And, you know, it's just beyond imagination to try to grasp what this is doing to our nation. What percentage of our nation do you think is currently on, of our adults and our children, are currently on psych drugs? And what percentage are exposed at one time or another? We don't have good data. What do you think is going on?
Well, it is kind of sketchy to try to put the numbers on it, but you know, it would seem to me that at least 60% of the country at one time or another has run up against these drugs, either, you know, chronically taking them, or a one-time horrendous experience, or spotty history of having taken various psychiatric drugs, maybe even more by this time, because so many more children, millions more, are on these drugs now. So it certainly seems to me to be upwards of 60 or 65% of the entire population. And then when you look at the ripple effect that goes out from that, now it's everybody, because everybody has a family member or a friend or somebody at work who, as a result of taking these drugs, has gone, you know, off the deep end, haywire in some way, whether it's just abject kind of sadness and passivity, or super aggressive, out of control behavior, becoming psychotic, whatever it is. So people around them are affected. And so that really means we're talking about everybody.
I think that's a basically good analysis. Among children, I mean, the estimates are beginning to look like 20% of our kids are on psychiatric drugs of one kind or another, with a substantial part of that being children on the stimulants, of course, but more and more on the neuroleptics and, of course, the antidepressants. We've got estimates now that are pretty firm of 20% of our active duty soldiers. This is such a horrendous plague. We are literally ruining the initiative and imagination and creativity of our population, both with the act of drugging and, as you so well pointed out, the idea of the categorizing, and then this huge overview of it, which is how many people think this way about themselves and about life. It's culturally, hardly anyone is talking about how bad this is and how extensive this is. It's just astonishing, and it's hard to imagine just what the long term consequences are gonna be for this and how we'll shake it off. On the other hand, I'm hearing people more and more, now that it's gotten so bad, more and more thinking this isn't right. I don't know if you're seeing that same trend.
I am. More people are talking about it, refusing to take the drugs, refusing to submit to the diagnoses that precede the prescription of the drugs, are just absolutely rejecting the whole thing. I remember when I was 19, maybe 20, and, I had some problems not getting along with certain people, family members, and so on. And so it was suggested that I go see a psychoanalyst, and I finally said, okay, just to make everybody happy, let's see what this is all about. And I was sent to see this guy who had a tremendous reputation at the time, Freudian psychoanalyst, and he said, look, you're in college and I'm far away, so you're not going to be coming down here four or five times a week, but I want to see you once a week, and I want you to go into New York and have a Rorschach test. I said, okay, whatever, and I drove down. I remember this very clearly. Parked the car somewhere in Manhattan and went in to see some kind of a, administrator, a technician, who had the inkblot tests all ready for me in his little office. And he was going to somehow make up a story about what this meant and would refer that back to the psychoanalyst, who would then take it from there. And so he said, okay, look, I'm going to show you a picture, and I want you to tell me what you see. And I said, well, you just want me to tell you a couple things that I see? He said, no, I want you to tell me everything you see. I said, okay. So he showed me the first picture. They all kind of look like big bats to me anyway. And I looked at it, and I began to talk about it, and then I began to home in on certain little sections and this and that and the other thing. And I was getting interested in this, you see, because I was already thinking about being a painter, and I was a writer. And I said, well, over here, this looks like a kind of a tank with a house next to it, and there's three guys standing on the roof. One of them has a balloon in his hand, and then there's a tiger coming. 20-25 minutes go by, right, and I'm still on the first picture. And this guy's now sweating. The sweat is coming into, beating on his forehead, and he's getting very tense because there's, a dozen more to go. And now I'm enjoying it because he's sweating. So I just keep on making up stuff. I mean, this is just, to me it's all imagination. Who cares what this is supposed to mean? It doesn't mean anything except I'm having a good time now. This is turning into a party for me. And finally, I can see his exasperation building, and he said, okay, that's enough. And I looked at him. I said, what's the matter? And he said, well, it's not important anymore. And I said, oh, so you just want me to tell you a few things? No, but, you've taken that far enough. I want to move on to the next one, And so he started the next one, and I did the same thing. So he cut me off after about 10 minutes of that, and he said, I have enough information now. We don't need to look at the rest of the pictures. And I walked out of the place, and I felt... at age 19, I really didn't know a lot about a lot of things, but there was something in me that was confirmed. I said, these people are insane. I'm not crazy. They're crazy. And they don't seem to understand that. They think that they've got the world, by the tail, and they can do whatever they want with it. And they're just running off in some crazy direction, and they have no idea what they're really doing. And so this was a revelation to me. These esteemed high-level professionals were absolutely in the dark. They were faking it from the beginning to the end, as far as I could see. And from that point on, I think my life basically changed because I had a completely different viewpoint about this whole thing. So that's the sort of thing I mean. It's, you know, somebody comes along with a fairy tale, and this is what it is, and we call it mental disorders, and we have a list of 300 or 400 of these, and you could be diagnosed with any one, and then you take these brain-slamming drugs on top of it, and this is our reality. How do you like it? Well, I don't like it at all, and I think a lot of other people are waking up to the fact that they don't like it either.
I think that's just so good. It's a really good analysis. John, I'm thinking back to the time I took some psychological testing. My dad was a very practical man, not at all psychologically oriented. And in high school, when I said I wanted to be a writer, I think that was a little scary to him. So he took me to a place that was, you know, reputable, not psychiatrically oriented. It was more oriented around occupational choices and stuff. And he had me, you know, spend a day there in New York. We lived on Long Island, taking this battery of tests. And the thing that I still remember, one set of questions was, what was more important, the freeing of the slaves or the Industrial Revolution? And I was in high school, but I remember saying, well, this is not writing down. This is not answerable. These things are so totally different in their outcomes and their values that are involved. I don't think you can weigh two things like that, and so on. So at the end, they concluded that I did have the profile, and they told this to me and my parents, of a writer. I looked like a lot of other writers they'd evaluated, but I just troubled much too much over philosophical issues, and I'd probably make myself miserable, and they literally recommended I go into doing something like advertising, copywriting. Can you believe? Well, then in college, I decided I wanted to go to medical school. So how different can it be? Writer, going to medical school. And my father, again, who knew nothing about psychology and decided again that maybe I should get some aptitude testing to see if medical school made any sense. And so they took me to a place that was called the Johnson O'Connor Institute of Human Engineering.
Oh, wow.
And the outcome was so interesting and so different. They put me through a bunch of tests, and they gave me the Rorschach. Isn't that interesting? And they said, we don't care what you say. We just want to see how many ideas you get from looking at the Rorschach. They gave me the exact opposite instructions that you were basically getting. And I just roared away with it as you did. And then they gave me another test, and I roared away with it. And they sat down with me and my parents, and they said, listen, his profile is really writer. They said it again. They said, but his imagination is so great, he could do anything. If he wants to go to medical school, have him go to medical school. Isn't that interesting?
That's fantastic.
It's like, you know, it's like, it's what you get. I mean, are you going to get somebody who's trying to liberate a young man and see his values? Are you going to get somebody who's doing what traditional psychiatry does and psychology, which is to pigeonhole you? Because how many people go to something that looks like psychological testing and come out with, hey, man, you got this marvelous imagination. Your words fly, thoughts fly. You're gonna do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've heard another story like that in all my experience.
No, I haven't ever heard a story like that. Yeah. But I've seen lots of people who become artists, literally save themselves, because the fundamental thing about becoming an artist is that they decide that what they're thinking has merit. What their ideas are, what their responses to the world are, that all of this, as it is, has merit and is a real starting point for creating. Instead of, gee, I better look at what I think and see what it really means in somebody else's universe, you know, who's got all these categories that they've cooked up, and then I will just become a slave to that. You know, they put that behind them at usually a fairly early age, and they said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go with what I've got as a starting point and then leave all that behind.
What strength it takes, well, good parents and strength it takes for you to do that when you're young. What I do, John, when these kids come in to me, you know, they're 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 16 years old, whatever, they've got all these supposed neuropsychological tests. They've got all these things about what's the matter with their executive functions or their concentration or whatever. And I literally tell the parents, you can take anybody apart, put all this stuff in some faraway place, and let's talk about your child's strengths, and let's us talk with your child about strengths. Let's see what your kid loves to do, and then you want to be a good parent, give him every opportunity you can to do what he loves to do. Life's going to be hard enough stopping him from what he wants to do that he loves, but let's see if we can help him do what he loves to do, because he'll have a good life. He'll have a good life. And it's, of course, turning psych testing on its head. It's saying the exact opposite of psych testing, which is find out what's the matter, and it's saying, you know, find out what the person loves, what's really good in their lives, what they want to make more of, and help them live that life. Help them live that life.
Absolutely.
We're so misguided now. Go ahead, John.
Amen to that, Peter. To get back to what you were saying earlier about freedom, you know, over the years, I've talked to a number of scientists in different disciplines about this whole issue of freedom, because my sneaking suspicion, which has been confirmed over and over again, is that a lot of these people don't believe it even exists. So that's really their starting point. And they say, well, you know, it's all about what's going on in the brain and these impulses and electricity and the neurons and the synapses. And if you want to analyze it down further, we get into subatomic particles and waves and this and that, which is just like everything else that's going on in the universe. And it's all just cause and effect, chains of cause and effect. And this is the real reality. And I've gotten into a few interview type situations with these people where I was really able to kind of go Socratic on them and lead them into various traps based on their own superficial thoughts. And it's very interesting because, well, two things. First of all, if they really don't believe that such a thing as freedom exists, then it becomes very understandable as to why they go into this psychiatric lunacy that they do, because to them it doesn't matter. It's just really rearranging impulses and particles. That's all it ever was for them. And so they're thinking, well, here's what the configuration looks like now, and with drugs we can change that to this, which is better by our standards. But it's really nothing about any of this has to do with freedom. See, so it doesn't really matter. If we fail, if we succeed, who cares, because it's just another pattern of impulses. There was never any real freedom to begin with. So this came as, you know, a real revelation to me. And the other thing was, when I would be able to get deep enough into the conversation with these people, I would come to the bottom line where I would say, well, look, we're having this conversation now, you and I. We're sitting here. So in what sense do we understand each other? Or is there anything of meaning in what we're actually saying? Because, you know, what you're telling me is that there is no such thing as freedom, and therefore, how can there be any such thing as consciousness except just subatomic activity? So where is the sense of what you're saying means something to me and what I'm saying means something to you? This is not an atomic concept of meaning and comprehension and understanding between two people. This is really something else, and you don't seem to really believe in that because you don't believe in freedom. So therefore, what difference does this conversation make? What difference does your point of view make versus my point of view? Why do you do anything at all? it doesn't matter. Plus, you have no choice over it anyway, as you've indicated. So you're really just another billiard ball on the table that's being hit by another billiard ball. So why do you care about any of this? Don't you see that if you maintain there's no such thing as freedom, you go into what, you know, Plato and Aristotle used to call reductio ad absurdum, or what the Romans eventually translated that as. What you believe eventually leads you to this monstrous absurdity that we are all just automatons here, and that there is no meaning, no understanding, no comprehension. That's all just a delusion. And why not, in that case, give up the delusion? And they just kind of look at me, and you know, they're kind of blinking away, and they don't know what to say, because they realize that their own premises are completely insane.
You're listening to John Rappaport talking with me, Peter Bregan, and we're going to have another half hour about freedom, responsibility, and who is there inside your head? Anybody home?
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
You're listening to the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, Progressive Radio Network.
Listen to your favorite PRN show in your car or when you're out for a jog? You can download any show on the archives at any time. Visit the archives at progressiveradionetwork.com/archives. We can also be found in the iTunes store under Progressive Radio Network. All our archives are free, so go ahead and check them out. Thanks for listening to the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned to stay informed.
Every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, I'll be revealing secrets, deceptions, and hoaxes of the medical cartel. I've been covering this waterfront for 30 years as a reporter, and I know where the bodies are buried. With guests and commentary, I'll rip open the lid on vaccines, psychiatric drugs, the FDA, pharmaceutical companies, germ research, and media cover-ups. Don't check your brain at the door. Tune it up. Every Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern on PRN, the John Rappaport Show.
Radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Listening to the number one internet radio station for progressive minds, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Dr. Peter Bregan talking with John Rappaport, who has his own website, nomorefakenews.com, and as you've just learned, his own show, 7 p.m. Wednesday nights. We are evolving in this show to the deepest questions that face you as a person. They may sound a little abstract at times or a little philosophic, but they're the essence of your life. And one of the most essential questions that you have to face on a daily basis, and which psychiatry forces us to face by denying our reality, one of your biggest questions is there anybody inside your head? Or are you molecules, biochemicals, balances and imbalances? Or are you somebody? Do you have free will or a measure of free will? Can you guide your life? Do you have imagination? Can your imagination bring forth new solutions to your life and new goodness into the lives of the people you touch? And ultimately, it gets down to, are you something like a soul or self? Are you a person? What does that all mean? I can tell you, in terms of my own personal life, the lives of my loved ones, my clients or patients, there's nothing more important than knowing that there's somebody, you are somebody, and that you can actually guide your life. You can take charge of your life. You can make decisions about your life. And psychiatry trains you to believe the opposite. It literally must train you to believe that you do not have the power to guide your life, so that you will accept these horrendous diagnoses and accept these horrendous life-suppressing drugs. So we get down to something very essential. And John, how far do you take this? Do you believe in a human spirit, a human soul? Do you believe in God or not in God? What do you believe when you get down to this really basic, who are we?
Well, I simply believe that each person is, you know, themselves, non-material being, a non-material being inhabiting a body. I mean, this was an ancient philosophy that in one form or another spread over a lot of the world for a long period of time. It was stated in various ways in different cultures and different spiritual systems, religions, and so on. And sometimes it was stated well and sometimes badly, and sometimes led to some very unfortunate conclusions, but there it was. And I think that it stands up. It's real, because you can actually, if you want to, I mean, I'm not saying that everybody needs to do this, but if you look at it as a real question that one could apply his or her mind to, I don't think you can really come up with anything but that answer in some form or another, because the alternative is absolutely ridiculous. The alternative is no freedom, no choice. Can't take charge of your life, can't guide your life, can't really plan the future. You're just a piece of material drifting along on the tide, and that's it. And so once that's the starting point, that, you know, a person is a non-material being, then we talk about freedom to make choices, imagination, creativity, to use freedom as a platform from which to create the future that you want, and to be responsible for that in the sense that, you know, you're making the choices, so you live with the consequences. And to me, that's a, you know, very reasonable starting point. And what it does when you throw that up on the screen over and against psychiatry is now psychiatry is thrown into extreme relief. You can see the comparison. You can see the contrasts, just as you've articulated it. They're saying, oh, well, you know, no, you're really a bundle of disorders. You have to submit to the diagnosis and then the drug. And the drug will do you harm. I mean, you don't say that, but that's the consequence. So we're really talking about two completely different views of what life is.
I really like what you're saying about being. I wrote a book a number of years ago called Beyond Conflict, in which I distinguished between being a being, being an agent, and being an object. And that if you're an agent, which is a lot of what we're talking about, you have free will and power, and you seek freedom. And then my next step was, if you're a being, you have inherent worth, whether you see it as coming from God or from some other existential concept. If you're a being, you have essential worth. You have, You have the ability to love. If you're an agent, you have the ability to take actions, and freedom is key. And if you're an object, then none of it matters. And you're a fit psychiatric patient. You're also a fit victim of oppression in any form. And I'm glad to be talking more about this with you, because I just rarely get into this, but I think it comes down to this. And I think that what makes someone like you, John, or me, who we are, is that somehow early on we really got the idea that individual people mattered, that we mattered and other people mattered. And I didn't have a way of expressing what that mattering was. I certainly didn't have that concept of being a soul or a being or something like that when I was 19. I hadn't been raised with any ideas like that. I wasn't going to learn them at Harvard for sure. But it's so key, and I just want folks who are listening to us to just get in touch with their inherent worth, their beingness, their inherent ability to be an agent, to take action. It's the starting point. And if you're going to help any other human being, if you're a therapist and you're going to help any other human being, or if you're a friend or any, if you're doing anything that's helping other folks, you got to see them as this combination of the being of essential worth, the non-material being of essential worth, and with that agency, the ability to act and to make decisions, and your right to do so. It's so basic, and psychiatry runs smack dab into that. I'll tell you one quick story. B.F. Skinner was the – it's not just psychiatry. It's psychology, much of psychology too. B.F. Skinner was the great American psychologist for generations, behaviorism, and the darling of the New York Times and of the intellectual elite of the country, because he said there was no one home. There is no – quote, ghost in the machine. There is no body there. We're all just a matter of input and output, basically. And I happened to meet Skinner at hearings on psychosurgery that I caused to happen. Ted Kennedy had pushed him to have these hearings on psychosurgery when I was carrying on my anti-psychosurgery campaign back in the 70s, and I met Skinner, and he talked about his views and at hearings, and I talked about mine. And I wrote him a note, and God, I wish I'd kept his responses buried somewhere in my files. I wrote him a note, and I said, Dr. Skinner, if you really believe all of this, how can you take pride in your own work and accomplishments? And he wrote me back and said one sentence. He said, I don't take pride in my accomplishments or my work. Wow.
Yeah. That's pretty fantastic, huh?
It's just astonishing. It's just astonishing. And in a sense, you know, all psychology, the way I view it, John, in a sense, all psychology is autobiography. I mean, if we're going to say people are machines, that's our autobiography.
Uh-huh.
If we're going to say that people can be sacrificed and manipulated and suppressed, that's our autobiography. But if we say, as you and I are, that people are beings, they have some inherent spiritual quality of inherent worth, and which gives us also the ability to make choices and to be agents or actors in our own lives, that's what we think about ourselves. So a lot of these psychiatrists and behaviorists with these dismal views of life, they're writing their own dismal autobiography and unfortunately imposing it on other human beings.
That's right.
When you've confronted people, you've described yourself as actively confronting people about these issues, which I rarely do. What kind of responses you get when you've got someone in that corner of, hey, what meaning does your life have?
Well, you know, if they're a materialist, they just try to kind of worm out of it with the usual, everybody knows by this time, science has shown us. It really, for them, comes down to a handful of cliches that they hold on to. That's what they're left with at the end. And sometimes you can see it in their faces, although they'll never admit it, that, you know, they feel defeated. They can sense within themselves that they're writing their own story of doom. But they will never come out and say, you know, you're absolutely right. I have to mention, because this is kind of very interesting, on my show on June 15th, which is going to be a week from this Wednesday, I'm going to be interviewing a guy named Clay Jenkinson, who has gone around the world. He's a scholar. He plays Thomas Jefferson. He gets dressed up as Jefferson. He enters into debates sometimes. He answers questions. He's a consummate performer, but also a Jefferson scholar. And so for an hour, I'm going to interview him as Thomas Jefferson. And I'm going to be asking him some of these questions that we're talking about here. Because at the beginning of this country, there was a very clear sense that people were free, that this was an inherent quality, and that it was worth risking everything for in order to establish a country in which this would be the keynote. This would be that which everything else was based on. And of course, yes, there were enormous downsides, and some people were hypocritical about it, and you can say all you want to about real versus pretended motives, but the country was founded. There was an essence of freedom that was proclaimed. It was embodied in documents, and it became the starting point for the republic called the United States. So this is the kind of thing I want to, you know, bring Jefferson back from the beyond and talk to him about this, which I will do, because what we're talking about here, Peter, to me, these are the essentials, you know. And if you can't think about the essentials, then you're going to fall prey to the people who want to manipulate you, everybody else in the future, and, as you say, impose their own worldview on everybody else. And that would be horrendous if we allow that to continue.
I'm 100% with you. You know, you may not even know, John, that about 2 years ago I wrote a little book called Wow, I'm an American, How to Live Life Like Our Heroic Founders. And I was just astonished to find out the degree to which all the founders believed that we are more than our brains and our bodies. How so many were, of course, fervent Christians, and some of them were fervent Jews. But even people like Jefferson and Franklin, who were seen as much more secular, had a deep belief in the human spirit, often connected to even an idea of an afterlife and of God, even if they weren't articulating a Christian ethic particularly. This country was really founded on people who believed we are beings and that we have freedom. One of the things that struck me enormously was the most popular metaphor throughout the lives of these men, Jefferson, Franklin, Samuel Adams, was Exodus. It was from the Hebrew Bible. It was Exodus. It was freedom. And in fact, Jefferson and Franklin wanted the Exodus to be on the seal of America. Didn't turn out to be that way. And they had a thorough grasp and were so devoted to the notion of the moral being. And they all believed that we wouldn't even have a free country. We wouldn't maintain a free country unless we saw ourselves as moral beings, taking responsibility for ourselves, taking advantage of freedom. This was a theme throughout the thinking and the writing of our founders. And it's just lost now. And it's the opposite of psychiatry. It's the opposite of totalitarianism. It's the opposite of materialism. I'm so glad to be. I had no idea where we were going to go today. I just knew you'd take us somewhere highly intelligent and important.
Yeah, I keep coming back to these basic concepts all the time because they are becoming lost. If you look at the news, just the news, and you would compare the news now to maybe 60, 70 years ago, you notice the number of times on the news that the word individual comes up, or the word liberty comes up, or the word freedom applied to the individual, not the group, comes up. And the idea of accountability or responsibility for one's own actions, or any sort of positive statements made about someone who has achieved something through the exercise of their own free will and creativity, that isn't presented as some sort of, soap opera type story, but just this is what we're all about. And you find that this is almost now completely absent from the news. It's not even there anymore. It's not on the radar screen. Everything is about the group or different groups. Everything is about the collective. Everything is about some sort of consensus reality that has to do with, well, in some cases, mental illness, psychiatry, disorders, or some sort of illness, to the point where, as I've said in many articles, I think that the real objective of what I call the medical cartel is cradle-to-grave care. Everybody in the world will be eventually diagnosed with 30 or 40 conditions, physical, mental, during their lifetime. They will receive diagnoses and treatments in the form of highly toxic drugs and surgery. And they will wear this as badges of honor. This will be the main thing that people talk about. What's your condition? What do you have? Well, this is what I've got. And three surgeons had to stand on their head for 16 hours in order to fix it in me. Well, that's fantastic. Would you like to come over for the weekend and tell my friends and family about this, because we're having a little get-together? And this is the real objective, that this becomes elevated as the highest sort of level of civilization, that everyone is a cradle-to-grave patient. And it's just the height of absurdity.
I'm with you. I'm totally with you. And I think you agree with me that it's far beyond just the health care. It's the whole issue of being taken care of versus being responsible for oneself. And we are shifting into being a society of folks who get taken care of. And this is the disaster for the people who get taken care of, and is not so good for those of us who are trying to take responsibility for ourselves either. It's a dreadful situation, and it is the opposite of the whole concept behind the American Revolution, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. In fact, there was a lot of anti-federalist writings. There were not just people supporting the Constitution. It's so interesting where the argument was at that time. The argument at that time was for a very limited federal government, which is what we ended up with, under a constitution, or a much, much more limited federal government with much more power in the states. The argument wasn't at all where it is today, how big the government. The argument was totally on the other side, and there were huge fears that even with the constitutional government, we had too big a government, that too much was being taken away from the states, that the government was going to be like King George and just run roughshod over the states, that we were losing what we'd fought for in the American Revolution. This was the argument going on back then. It wasn't even close to the argument now, which is so much more about, how big will be the government? How taken care of will we be? How thorough will the cradle to grave be? And it won't just be diagnoses. It'll be what we're taught, how we're educated, what we're supposed to think. Ah, John, I rarely go on about this because I think that my great contribution is more in the area of psychiatry per se, but this basic stuff is so, so, so important.
Yeah, it really is. And your fantastic contribution to psychiatry, the way I see it, would not have been possible had you not, been grounded all along in these ideas that we're discussing here. Because how could you see the real depth of what's going on to make this, listeners, if they don't already know, should know. You're way up there, Peter, in what you've been able to accomplish to get people to wake up and realize what's happening in the whole field of biological and chemical psychiatry. But people also have to realize, where does this ultimately come from, or what made it possible in your case to be able to do this is to know that there is such a thing as freedom to begin with, because all of that implies, because if that weren't the case, then you would not have been able to sustain this for all these years.
Freedom and the notion that we are all beings, that we all have worth. That when I stepped into the state mental hospitals as a volunteer at the age of 18 at Harvard, and you know, this program that I ended up running, it was just so apparent to me that the folks being tortured in the name of psychiatry, being locked up in the name of psychiatry and so on and so forth, were not essentially different from me. I might have been luckier, I might have had more gifts, but they weren't essentially different from me. So I think it's what it began with me was a knowledge about freedom, but even more, what I think is even in some ways deeper than freedom, the knowledge that all people had worth and deserve to have their own lives. They had inherent worth. So I think that for me may have come before the freedom, even was the empathy, the understanding that we're all basically have value and shouldn't be mistreated and abused and restrained and contained. But I can also understand that it might start with freedom and it might start with both those values. They're inextricable. What do you think?
Yeah, they are. You can't really have one without the other. I mean, each of those implies the other.
Yes.
Because what is freedom unless you really understand that every individual being has worth and vice versa? You can have worth if there's no such thing as choice. I mean, what difference would that make in that case, you know? And this is gone from the schools, too. I mean, where do you see discussion of individual freedom in the schools? I certainly don't see it anywhere. I used to be a teacher. I've talked to many teachers over the years. I just don't see this anymore. It's not there. And some people think, well, that's a great idea. It shouldn't be there because we have to think about what's good for everybody. But you see, that becomes a fiction because if you don't see the individual as having basic worth, then it doesn't matter how many individuals you accumulate together and call them a group. It's not going to work out for that group because the group is composed of individuals. So you run into all these brick walls unless, as you say, you begin with the notion, the reality, the truth that every individual has worth and every individual has freedom and every individual has the ability to create and imagine his own or her own future.
And I want to really emphasize for those of you listening that this is not an abstract discussion. This is something you need to feel in your heart, that you have essential worth, whether it's from God or from some other existential source, that you have essential worth and that your freedom matters. And that if you really bring that into your heart, it will change your life, along with taking responsibility for that worth and taking responsibility for that freedom. And if you treat other people who touch you and pass you by in your life, however briefly even, if you greet them as people of inherent worth whose freedom you respect, you will promote life, enhance life everywhere you go. This is Dr. Peter Bregan. I have loved having on my friend John Rappaport. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.